Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 15th, 2009, and this is show number 195. Do you realize we're getting really close to the 200th episode? What are we going to do to celebrate? You guys are ever so much more clever than I am. Think up something that requires, say, no work on my part, okay? I think that would be really fun. Seems like we ought to be able to pull something off here, don't you think? At the last podcast expo, or a couple of podcast expos ago, I had the great pleasure of getting to meet a guy named Slough. It was one of the high points of the show for me, and I didn't even realize at the time that he was the one that wrote the fantastic PodSafe Christmas carol called If Every Day Were Christmas. If you're ever interested in getting that, it's available over at podsafeforpeace.org. Anyway, Slough is a recording artist. He has a recording studio, and he's been promising to do a podcast for ages, and he's finally started releasing some episodes. I listened to the episode where he works with Jordan Potter and Matthew Conrad, and I was absolutely entranced. He mixes music in with that he's been recording while he's talking about what's going on behind the scenes, and his description of what goes into making this recording is really, really interesting. He's so gifted at storytelling. I love to hear him. It's fantastic, and I know you're thinking, but Allison, you don't even like music. Well, you've got me there, but think about it. Consider if I liked it, it must be really, really good if you actually like music. Anyway, go check it out at sessionswithslough.com.
Dumb questions.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Kate writes in with a good dumb question. By the way, I categorize good ones as the ones I can find the answers to. I don't have to know the answer up front, but if I can find it pretty easily, that counts as a good dumb question. She writes, "Hi, Allison. It's Kate from southeastern Michigan again. Great answer the last time, even if it wasn't what I wanted to hear. C'est la vie." Here's another. Apple's quick tip of the week on advanced finds said in their RSS feed, "macOS 10 Leopard has a great search tool, accessible in the menu bar or from any Finder window. Spotlight lets you search any Mac on your network, perform calculations, look up definitions, launch applications, search recently visited websites, and much more. Using Spotlight, you can also define laser-specific search criteria simply by pointing and clicking." Well, their video didn't address any of those items their blurb referred to. So, how do I search any Mac in my network? I can already calculate, define, and launch. I know how to do that. And what do you think using Spotlight, you can also define laser-specific search criteria simply by pointing and clicking means? Doesn't that sound like fun? You know, I love your show, although Bart's security light bits give me the heebie-jeebies. And tell Honda Bob I wish I had a Honda and lived in Orange County. Well, I did ask her permission to use that heebie-jeebie line. I think that's kind of the point of security light, is to give you the heebie-jeebies, but then calm you back down by giving you a really easy way to fix the problem that he explains. But anyway, let's get back to the spotlight questions. I think Kate will like my answer a little better this time. She's absolutely right. That laser focus thing always gets me excited. I did a couple of searches, and I found a link on Lifehacker to usingmac.com where they actually explain how to get that laser search. The basic idea is you type in your search term followed by kind and a colon and the kind of thing you're looking for. For example, I typed in podcast space kind colon text and it found a whole bunch of text documents with the word podcast embedded in them. In 1/10 the time that Windows would even find the word podcast if it were the name of my hard drive. Well, how about after Spotlight finds a file, what if you just want to see where it is, not open it? Turns out hitting Command Return will show you the file in the Finder. There's even Boolean terms you can use in there. Like you want the file that has boogers in it but doesn't have the word snot, you could type in boogers not snot. It's amazing what you can do with this thing. Check it out. They've got all kinds of cool shortcuts that you can use there if you like Spotlight. And I noticed that Using Mac also had Quicksilver actions in there too, so they've got something for Bart and me. As far as using Spotlight to search the network, though, the only thing I could find is that if you had Mac OS X Server, you're supposed to be able to do that. I might have missed it, but I couldn't find it anywhere. Maybe one of the listeners out there is smarter than me. Okay. So like most of the listeners out there are smarter than me, but I mean, maybe one of them actually knows how to do Spotlight over network drives and can figure that out for us. I should mention at this point that during Bart and my recording, he went to launch Disk Utility and he got some totally other application. And I said, well, wait a minute, Bart, I thought it was supposed to be able to learn what your search terms were. And he said, well, yeah, but I'm on a different Mac right now. And I said, oh, I thought the cool part about Spotlight was that it didn't matter which Mac you're on because it didn't have to be any different. It was always the same. And he did not have a very good answer to that. A few weeks ago, I did a review of Delicious Library, which is an application that lets you scan in DVD barcodes and create a database of your movies. It also lets you scan in tons of other things, but I mostly only cared about the DVD portion. I'd been wanting this for years because so many people had given it positive reviews, so I finally broke down and bought it during the Mac Expo this year. As you know from my review, I was fairly happy with it, but there was enough that didn't work the way I liked it to make me wonder if there might be something better out there. Scott Patz heard the review and he wrote this. In show number 192, you didn't exactly give Delicious Library a rave review. Well, I have an alternative application for you to look at. It's called DVDpedia from brewgy.com/DVDpedia. This program does one thing and it does it great. It keeps track of your DVD library. Only your DVD library, not your tools, clothing, etc. Just like Delicious Library, though, DVDpedia can scan a DVD barcode, or you can just manually enter a movie title. The program will look it up off Amazon and or Internet Movie Database, IMDb, all of the movie information and movie cover art. The feature I love the most is the Front Row or Apple TV plugin, which will add a DVDpedia menu item to your Front Row Apple TV menu. Within DVDpedia, you can link to any store movie file. By using this, my two kids can access all of our legally ripped DVDs I store on an external hard drive attached to a Mac Mini. Among the many other features you may appreciate, there are a bunch of HTML export options to save off, upload your movie collection. Keep up the great show, Scott. Well, thanks, Scott. I had to give this a try on your recommendation. I have to confess right off the top that I did cheat when I used DVDpedia. When I read in the documentation that I could import all of the movies I'd scanned from Delicious into DVDpedia, I could not bring myself to rescan the almost 300 movies I'd scanned into Delicious Library. I did go through the process of scanning a few just so I could test that feature and compare it to the way Delicious Library worked, because I was kind of disappointed at how few actually worked. I mean, I don't know, I was getting maybe 60-70% kind of numbers of how many would actually scan in. So I tested it in DVDpedia, and I had about the same results. I think I did 8 movies, and only 5 of them scanned in correctly. The other ones just sat there and didn't do anything. So basically, it's just as bad at scanning things in as Delicious was. I think we may be working with a limitation in the scanner capability of the spot of the iSight itself might be the problem. Just like Delicious Library, though, it was easy enough to run the search by hand by entering the title and flipping through the matches it finds. However, DVDpedia does a much better job of showing you what it finds. This is another one of my pet peeves with Delicious Library. It shows you a list of what it found with teeny tiny little images and a truncated title, so telling whether they're showing you the widescreen or the director's cut version is completely impossible. DVDpedia instead gives you a giant image and all the info about the movie it found, so you're sure you've got the right one. The downside is you have to flip through all the matches, but I prefer this method 5-to-1 over the way it worked in Delicious Library. Like I said early on, DVDpedia will import the data from Delicious Library, but I did have to downgrade to Library 1 format since I was on Delicious Library 2. Once I figured that out, I was able to export and then import right back in a few minutes, and I was up and running. I should back up a little bit and start more at the beginning and describe the interface on DVDpedia. Across the top, you have a whole lot of buttons. Down the left, you can see your collections. On the right is a list of all your DVDs. And across the bottom half is where you see the DVD you've chosen to view, with the album art on the left and a full description over on the right. Right away, I like this view much better than the fancy eye candy of Delicious Library. In Delicious Library, they show you these beautiful bookshelves with your DVDs sitting on the bookshelves. I mean, it's really pretty, but I couldn't figure out how to alphabetize my DVDs. Somebody, I wish I could remember who, gave me a way of getting them alphabetized, but it was this kludgy workaround. All you do in DVDpedia is click on the title column, and they're alphabetized by title. Duh. You could sort by director, studio, ratings, and genre. You could probably add more columns, but those are the ones that came up with. Now that's what I'm talking about. If you're a visual kind of person, that's okay too. Click on the icon view, and all your beautiful album art comes up on screen so you can scan through to find what you're looking for. Maybe you're a Coverflow fan. They've got that too. Works perfectly. If nothing else in DVDpedia were better than Delicious Library, right now I would still be sold on DVDpedia over Delicious Library. Right here, the fact that I can sort my movies in alphabetical order is better. But there's more. DVDpedia even lets you see a beautiful full-screen view of all your DVDs in a row with beautiful reflections on a black background. You know, that Apple reflection thing. You can click through, arrow through, or even use your scroll on your mouse to flip through all your movies and watch them fly by. Now, this is eye candy that's actually useful. DVDpedia has a borrow button at the top so you can record when someone borrowed a movie and how long you promised it to them. It integrates with Address Book, so as you type in their name, it fills it in for you. Very cool. The DVD disappears from your library and moves to a collection called Borrowed. Get this, if you have a movie selected, you can even view the borrowed history so you can see who you loaned it to in the past, so you don't keep trying to get your friend Diane to borrow Spinal Tap. You'll know she already saw it. Heck, you can even look Diane up in the Address Book inside DVDpedia, and you can see what movie she has borrowed. So let's say you're working her through the entire Alien series, for example. You could check and see which one she saw last. If you're really anal, you can record when you view a movie, and then later, when you're trying to decide what to watch, you can see when you last viewed a movie. And if you get in an argument with your husband saying, "Oh, we just saw that one 2 weeks ago," you can actually check it in DVDpedia. I'm not sure I'd do more than note who borrowed a movie, but having that capability is still cool. What I do know I wanted was a nice web export. You may remember that Delicious Library created beautiful web pages, but they were nearly useless. The movies didn't go up in alphabetical order, they weren't in genre order, and I could never figure out what order they were in. There was no way to sift through the dozens of pages to even find a particular movie. DVDpedia does a much better job of this. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to figure out exactly how to FTP it to my website using their FTP button, but I was able to create the web album on my disk and just FTP it myself without any trouble. DVDpedia supports Mobile Me, so you can plop your collection up on your .Mac account if you like to. By the way, I refuse to call it .Me. Doesn't that still sound stupid? I am not getting used to that name. Anyway, there are about a dozen HTML templates to choose from, which makes it really fun to stylize your site. I chose the iPhone template because I would very much like to view these movies on my iPhone when I'm out and about, and because I find that template to be really snappy on a web browser. It's really clean looking. Get this, DVDpedia lets you alphabetize it. Hey, what do you think? It's crazy. On the web, alphabetized. You can also have it separated by letter, so all of the A's are on one page, B's on the next. Makes sense. When you choose that format, you get an index across the top with letters, so you can just click on the letter Q and realize that, yes, your husband Steve did buy Queen, We Will Rock You in some lack of judgment moment. I love the output of DVDpedia. It's exactly what I was hoping for, and I wasn't able to find in Delicious Library. I put a link in the show notes to my DVD library from DVDpedia so you can see how cool it looks and how weird our tastes are. Again, you might think that's all, but you'd be wrong. There's still more. You can export your DVD library to your iPod. Plug in the iPod, name your collection, and then in just a few seconds, you can navigate to the notes section on your iPod and search your entire library. Every DVD is a separate line in the collection, and when you select it, you can see the text description of the DVD. Unfortunately, the iPhone and iPod Touch don't support the notes feature, so I was not able to export it to my iPhone. But that's not the fault of DVDpedia. I keep thinking I'm done explaining how cool this application is, and I find yet another cool feature. How about some statistics for those of us who love that sort of thing? There's a stat button, and from that I learned that our favorite director is evidently Steven Spielberg, with 5 movies by him. And let's see, under actors, William Shatner, James Doohan, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly, shockingly, are our top 4 actors. Anyone shocked at this? Really can't figure out why that might be? Well, Tom Cruise just barely beat out Nichelle Nichols for the number 5 and 6 slot. We clearly like action and adventure more than any other genre, with 81 titles in that category. And second is comedy with 57, and oddly, science fiction only had 18. Our favorite studio is Warner Home Video with 31 titles. 20th Century Fox and Paramount almost tied at 21 and 22. Did I mention that I really love statistics? I discovered from these lovely bar graphs that I prefer PG-13 movies 50% more than PG or R movies. How about that? You can even see what year your favorite movies were made. Evidently, 2003 was a good year for us. 51.11% of the movies we buy are also between 1.5 hours and 2 hours long. 20% of them go over 2 hours. Okay, this is getting kind of comical what they've collected here. You might be getting bored, but I love this stuff. Our favorite aspect ratio is evidently 2.35 to 1, with 1.85 to 1 and 1.33 to 1 a distant second, and a distant second and third out of our 155 videos. 112 of our 155 videos are in Dolby. I bet you're glad I kept going on about these stats, huh? Hey, I just noticed we don't have 300 videos like I said at the beginning. Looks like we only have 155. Oh, well. They even show you which movies you purchased the most recently. But I'm not sure those dates make any sense because it says I bought 10 movies on February 15th. I think that's the day I scanned them all into Delicious. Yeah, that's too bad. Well, believe it or not, I did not read you all of the statistics, just the really good ones. Bottom line is that DVDpedia blows the socks off of Delicious Library. The ability to sort my DVDs, view nice eye candy, have much more flexibility with the web interface, especially having an index on the web, fantastic tracking on what you've loaned out, and of course, all those cool statistics, they make DVDpedia a winner up against Delicious Library. But get this. Delicious Library is $40. DVDpedia is $18. Unbelievable. Go pick it up at brewgy.com/DVDpedia. This week's Honda Bob ad comes courtesy of Stu Helm and Will Pryor.
Ah, Los Angeles.
Doctor, what do you mean, Los Angeles?
Well, the thing about Los Angeles is, it's where I come to get my TARDIS repaired.
But who'd repair a TARDIS in Los Angeles?
Well, the thing about the TARDIS is, it's a Honda. Underneath all the Time Lord, time travel stuff, of course.
So that must mean we're going to see...
Honda Bob!
He repairs Hondas and Acuras in the L.A. or Orange County areas.
But how do we contact him?
We could always phone him at 562-531-2321. After all, this is a police public call box, isn't it?
Yeah, but the phone doesn't always work in here. Or we could email him at hdabob@aol.com.
Do you mean hdabob?
Well, his website, hdabob.com.
But of course, HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
Right then, here we go. Now, where's that parking meter? Gotta have this thing towed away, you know? It's got the secrets of the Time Lords in it.
Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartBU.ie. How are things in Ireland today, Bart?
Oh, things are very good. I've been very decadent today. I have a cup of freshly brewed coffee from ground beans percolated with fresh cream. So,
ooh, yum. So you're going to be up till like 7 in the morning?
Well, if truth be told, I only finished my breakfast at 4 in the afternoon. That's not because I was in bed till 4 in the afternoon, but by the time I had finished doing shopping and then cooking and stuff, I didn't actually start cooking breakfast till 3:30.
I love it. Hey, you know what? I need a MagSafe connector for my headphones. I stood up yesterday and I had somehow the wire had gotten wrapped around my foot, and I was sitting on my foot on the chair and I picked up and I almost pulled my laptop off the table.
Oh dear. No, I'm convinced that everything that has a wire should be MagSafe, because I trip over them all of them. Power, USB, headphones, Ethernet, you name it. I'll trip over them all.
Ethernet as a MagSafe. That'd be interesting.
Why not?
That's true. I think because someone owns the patent.
Oh, yeah, those people.
Ooh, but they could make some money. Well, anyway, we should probably get into the show. That was just a sideline. But what do we have on Security Light today, Bart?
I just had a few little updates, really. Nothing new to add. I think it's 2 weeks ago we talked about the issue with Acrobat, and then we talked about it again last week, actually. And Adobe had promised an update on March 11th, and on March 11th, Adobe released an update. So if you have either Adobe Acrobat or Adobe Reader on any platform, go ahead and update it. It will probably try to update itself, but I don't know for sure because I don't like Adobe software, so I don't have any.
I have Adobe Air running in it, and then that ran an update.
Oh, yeah, probably I do have Air. Yeah. Okay, that's the only bit of Adobe software I have, but I didn't pay for it.
Okay, good. So now there was a there was some link to preview. Is there still a problem in preview?
Preview hasn't been patched. So we know that some security firms say there's an issue in preview too. There hasn't been any reports of it being actually exploited.
Okay.
Whereas the Windows one, some very troubling stuff came to light over the week where when some of the antivirus firms found, you know, they wrote a definition to spot this attack and then they ran it through some historical data and realized that it's been used by the bad guys since January.
Oh, wow.
So that's not good.
Yikes. Okay. All right. Let's see. What else? Did we hit a patch Tuesday?
We did indeed. Three Windows updates. One of them marked critical, remote code execution, usual stuff. So Windows asked to update itself, allow it to. And if you have any Windows virtual machines, now would be a good time to fire them up, patch them, and then put them back to sleep.
That's something that's so hard to remember because I've still got one running on one machine, but I forget all about it because I don't actually use it for anything.
Yeah, so that's why I always like to remind Mac users that all their little virtual machines, they need to be updated too.
Right. You know, the only way I knew there was a patch Tuesday was on Wednesday I was sitting talking to a guy and my PC at work was going at the disk. And I'm thinking, what is that?
What's
and I
doing?
Went, oh, today's Wednesday. Must have been patch Tuesday yesterday.
It's updating itself.
Definitely. Well, let's see, we put off a subject from last week because we had other exciting things to talk about with Robert Lachman, but you wanted to talk about cha-ching.
Well, I figured, you know, it's nice to do the odd software review. That's what we used to always do, but we don't end up doing it very often anymore.
Is this odd software?
Hmm?
Is this odd software?
I suppose you could argue it is. It's financial software, so I guess we're being sort of up-to-date with the current climate. I don't know about you guys, but here in Ireland, things are pretty bad at the moment, and all of us in the public sector have had basically a 7% pay cut, which is not insignificant, on top of the 1% national pay cut, which is they call a levy. So we have a lot less money than we used to.
Wow.
Yeah, they actually took 1% off everyone's gross pay of the entire country.
Really?
Yeah, they called it a levy.
As a tax? Oh,
but it's
my
not
God.
A tax, it's a levy, so it comes in before your tax-free allowances.
Isn't that special?
It truly
where,
special.
Where'd the 7% come from?
That's a levy for the pension I pay for.
That you were already paying that before, or you just, okay.
Yeah, I pay my pension contributions, and because I have a state pension, I now have to pay a 7% levy as well as my pension contribution. Go figure.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
Yes.
So it's important to try to figure out where you're wasting your money so you can save it up to buy more Mac gadgets, right?
Pretty much, actually, yeah. That's pretty much exactly what it comes down to. So, yeah, this
is
definitely
my friends Dean and Suzanne are both looking for some software for the Mac to manage finances, and I told them that you were going to do a brilliant review of Cha-Ching this weekend.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how brilliant it is. I tried this a couple of years ago, when money was tight for different reasons. And at that stage, I wanted something free, so I tried a free Linux-based one. I think it was called Kcache or something silly like that. I don't actually remember what it was called, but I'm sure it started with a K because it was a KDE app. And I never got very far because all the words were too confusing. And I'm not an accountant, and I didn't know what anything meant. And, you know, when you don't even know what the things in the menu mean, you're not going to get very far.
Right, right.
So what I heard about Cha-Ching was that it was really simple, very Mac-like, and that it used tagging for most things. And I thought, I know what tags are, and I like simple Mac software. So I decided that Cha-Ching would be my logical starting place. And it is, without a shadow of a doubt, the simplest finance software I've ever seen. Quicken, this is not. QuickBooks, this is not. which is both its strength and its weakness.
So it might be more for normal people then.
Well, I've actually managed to use it for the last 2 months to keep track of the money. So that in itself is a massive victory because I've never gotten that far before with any other software I've tried.
Right.
But it's simplistic. Transferring money from one account to another, very poorly supported. So what I end up doing is simply doing two transactions as if they're not related at all. I do a debit from one account and a credit to another account.
Okay.
And then I tag it as a transfer using a tag.
So what does this allow you to do in the big picture? What's the basic functionality you're getting out of it?
I put into it all the money that goes in and out of my bank accounts, and at the end of the month I can see how much I spent this month and what I spent it on.
So the main thing is what you spent it on, right? Because
yes,
you can go to your bank and download and see online banking sort of thing. You can see that you spent money, but all it says is $238 at Best Buy.
Yeah, and so I tag all the expense, all the expenditure into various categories. So, you know, in more traditional financial software, you do that by sort of double accounting, where you'd have a groceries account, and then you would transfer money from your cash account to your groceries account to represent buying groceries, and all that kind of head-wrecking stuff. Whereas here you just say, debit so much, tag groceries.
Okay.
And then basically you do your main work through smart folders. So you can set up a smart folder for how much you spent on groceries in the last month, and then you'll know.
So in theory, you would start to see your grocery bill go up and your dining out or your
takeout
Chinese start to go down, and that'll mean that you're spending your money better, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the important thing is it's very like iTunes in some ways. So it has across the top, so you can see all transactions, you can see reconciled transactions, you can see pending transactions. It has a scheduler in it so that if you have monthly expenditure, they can get automatically scheduled in as being due.
Which is
particularly handy, because I had a terrible habit of going overdrawn for the simple reason that I'd completely forgotten that I had a bill due.
So you just set up a trigger to remind you to pay the bill. You're not actually paying the bill through the software, right?
Yeah, exactly. It just shows up in the software. So it shows up as an upcoming transaction.
I'm looking at a screenshot that they have at the midnightapps.com website, and I love it because it's showing everything the money was spent on. iPod Nano, Apple TV, Xbox 360, a DVD. Oh, it's an Xbox 360 hard drive, a Nintendo Wii, Angels and Dreams, Da Vinci Code, a MacBook, and a Sony camera.
So wow, it looks like
one of our typical
I'd love
no
to spend on things like
in
that.
The list. Right, right.
You can also attach stuff. So if you buy something, you can attach like a picture of the thing you bought for, I don't know, insurance reasons or something. It also backs up to your .Mac account or your Mobile Me account, which is nice.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
But really, to me, it sort of treats transactions like iTunes songs, really, because you can filter them on all sorts of things. So you can, you know, display transactions this month, transactions last year, custom range, all pending, incoming, outgoing. You know, it's the whole interface is very, you'd be very used to it from other stuff. And you just simply put in all your transactions and it keeps track of things.
So the two things I would want to get out of it, one would be the scheduler thing, like you say, remember to actually pay the bill. I have no idea when my bills are due. My bills are due when Steve yells at me that I've been forgetting it on the counter for 3 days. that's when I know. That would be one thing. But the other thing would be, would I start changing my behavior? Like if I start seeing that, dang, you know, I've really been eating out too much, or I've been, you know, spending a lot of money at Best Buy, I really should cut that back. Have you found that you've changed behavior to where you're saving the money to spend on the things you really think are important?
Very much so, because at the end of the month, when you look over what you've spent and you see a load of stuff showing up, you know, under entertainment or under tech is the tag I use for quite a lot of stuff, you know, you start to say, well, that's really too much. There's only so much money coming in, and that's too much to be spending on that.
Okay. So it starts making you change your behavior then?
It certainly has in my case. Now, I used to be quite blasé about these things. I would just sort of go to the shop and I would buy whatever I wanted. And then I would hand over my little piece of plastic and it would all be fine. But those days are gone for the next while anyway.
Right, right. Or until you get some more web work or something, right?
Yeah, but if you're stumbling from, you know, irregular work to irregular work, you can't really count on that. So you have to get your monthly habits within your monthly income.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. Well, that sounds pretty good. How much does cha-ching cost?
$40, which worked out quite cheap for us Europeans yet again. Wow.
Sorry about the dollar doing better, though. I feel bad about that.
It's not doing that much better, thankfully.
Okay. Well, for a while there, it was like 1.5. What's the exchange rate right now?
1.3, 1.4, I thought. Unless it's gone down again. It's possible it has. But I have my hosting in American dollars these days, and I've noticed that what comes out as being over 100 American dollars is still coming in at being under 100 euro, so that's fine.
Oh, okay, that's good. Well, you know, we're glad to be of help on that.
Yeah, I just need to keep it up for at least a year because I'm stuck in a one-year contract. So if the dollar goes completely the other way, I'm a little hosed.
Let's see. Darn, it's 1.3, Bart. 1.28.
That's fine.
Okay, good. As long as it's less than 1-to-1, you're good.
Yeah, even if it goes to 1-to-1, I'm still saving money. It's when it goes the other way, I start to lose money.
Oh, okay, good. Well, let's see. So again, it's from midnightapps.com. Mm-hmm. It looks like a nice little application. Pretty good.
The other thing that we should mention, actually, is that according to their website, there's an iPhone version, quote, coming soon.
Ooh, so if you could sync, so if you remember in the store, you'd have a little better time doing it.
Yeah, exactly. It's sometimes nice to be able to actually enter stuff as you're going along instead of... That's the hard bit for me with any of this financial software, is making time once a week to sit down and actually, you know, make your software reflect reality again.
Right. So if you can do it while you're out and you're bored somewhere, that's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you're traveling for business and stuff, it could be very handy.
In looking at Cha-Ching, it looks like the fact that it's fun and pretty looking and familiar would be a big plus to actually not dreading doing it.
Exactly. And it behaves very like you would expect it to. I don't think I've looked at the manual. I just went, oh, okay, I'll create a new account then. Oh, okay, I'll create a new transaction then. You know, little plus buttons. It's very, very Mac-like. So what you expect, it does what you expect, basically.
Good. All right, well, I'm going to kick into a new topic here. So, you know, fine. I told you I do backups, right? I do backups every week. I do backups because I once didn't save our recording and you were really cranky at me. So I do my backup on a schedule. As soon as I'm done, I plug in my backup drive and I run Super Duper. And I told you that my offsite backup strategy is that I keep my laptop in my car. And you said, well, that's cute for when you're not at home, but what about when you're in your house? And you made little tsk tsk kind of noises about how that wasn't quite appropriate. So fine, I need an offsite backup strategy, but I keep this is too hard, Bart. I've got 80 gigabytes of photographs, right? 80 mm-hmm. gig of photos. So I thought, okay, well, I can burn on DVDs, take it to work or something. I can't put on DVDs 5 gig. That's not going to work. Well, I could do something like iDisk or S3 or Jungle Disk, and I'd have to pay for that. But I'd be willing to do that. But it's going to take me 12 years to upload my photos there.
Yeah, not a good idea.
So, you know, some people say, okay, well, you know, make a backup and take that backup offsite, you know, on a hard drive and then bring it back home, swap it out for the other one, that kind of nonsense. But it already takes me over an hour to run a backup every week. I'm not going to do that either. I mean, that's a pain. So tell me, wise one, how am I supposed to do it?
Okay, I don't like the idea of my two backups ever meeting. So what I do, because my main machine is a laptop, which is a luxury you have as well, my backup drive sits in work. I come in the morning, I plug in my laptop, I set it off synchronizing once a week, and then I ignore it, because I'm not allowed to use my Mac for work purposes. So it just sits in the corner doing the backup, and then in the evening I close it over, stick it in my bag, and the hard drive goes into my desk.
Well, that'd be kind of easy for me, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Since I'm already putting it in the car, all I have to do is remember to drag it into work once a week.
Yeah, and like I do it once a week, Fridays. I do it Fridays usually.
Actually, if I did it on like a Wednesday or Thursday or something like that, then I'd have two backups a week, actually, since one of them's on Saturday.
That would be a good idea.
That's not a bad idea. That might actually work.
Now, I'll give you a word of caution, of course. You don't want to have your personal data lying around in a hard drive in work unencrypted, just sitting in your desk drawer for the cleaners to come and have a read of.
But all I have is like photos and stuff. I don't have anything sensitive. I don't keep like finance records or insurance or medical information on there. Do I really care?
It's highly unlikely your machine contains no personal data at all. The chances are that you have a few saved passwords in Safari or in Firefox. The chances of your machine being completely free of any data that could be of interest to attackers is low. Even if it's just data they can gather for the purpose of targeting you with a phishing attack. You know, your habits are very valuable.
I see. So, well, okay. So now is this going to get hard?
No. This is OS X. Why would it get hard? What I've done is I've set up a sparse disk image. which I've password encrypted, and I've taken a note of the password. Somewhere secure and somewhere safe. And then I've added it to my keychain. So in terms of the day-to-day stuff, when I plug in my laptop and I mount the drive, it just mounts automatically. But if anyone else takes that drive and plugs it into any other machine, they're not going to get the data off that disk image.
Okay, so I hope the Mac Geek Gab guys aren't listening, but what is a sparse disk image? And I think we've even talked about it before, but I just I don't understand.
It's a pretend hard drive in a file.
Okay, so I plug my hard drive in at work. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to show up on your desktop.
Okay, and I'm going to press the super duper button.
Okay, well, not in this case, you wouldn't press the super duper button straight away. You plug in the hard drive and it shows up on your desktop. Then you would go into there with the finder, and there would be a file in there called, you know, Allison's offsite backup.sparse disk image, for example. Double click that to actually mount the sparse disk image.
I lost you already.
Okay.
I plugged in the hard drive. Where did that sparse disk image come from?
It's on the hard drive. You store it. It's a sparse disk image is just a file, but when you double click it,
create it though.
Oh, it's created first. Okay.
Okay. Just go back to day one.
Disk utility. So you go into disk utility. If you told me you were going to do this, I would have prepared a little.
I didn't know I was going to do my backups at work.
Okay. Well, not directory utility. I have no idea what you are, but that's not what I wanted to launch. Disk utility.
Okay, see, if you were using Quicksilver, you could have typed DU and you'd be in it
already. I did type DU and hit enter, but it brought up the wrong DU.
Oh, so it didn't learn like you said in Spotlight, huh?
Actually, I'm on a different machine.
Oh, but I thought the value of Spotlight was it works the same everywhere, so you didn't have to worry about that, Bart.
Yeah, but you still have to read what you're doing. If you type in and just hit enter without looking at what you're doing, it isn't going to work very well.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you go to File, New, Blank Disk Image. That'll pop up dialogue, so you specify a file name and where you'd like to save it to. So give it a name like Allison's Offsite Backup and stick it onto your external hard drive.
Wait, but there's a whole bunch more questions. Like
volume
size.
We're getting there.
Okay.
So volume size, pick the biggest it's ever going to get. So I just pick the actual size of my hard disk. It won't actually use that space until it needs to, but that's as big as it can get.
Okay.
Volume format, leave it at macOS Extended Journals, because that's a good file system. Encryption, you want to set to you need to set it to one of the two options, either 128-bit AES or 256-bit AES. I think 128 bits is more than enough, and that's actually what it recommends. But if you work for the NSA, you probably want to go for the 256-bit option, which is marked as more secure but slower.
I don't know. Somebody might get to my Facebook password, though, Bart. I might need to go 256 on that.
I think it's a case of placing a reasonable barrier in front of an attacker.
Okay.
I'd be inclined to say 128 is more than enough. 128 bits of encryption is pretty big, let's be honest.
Okay. All right.
Partitions, just a single partition will do fine, and you want a read-write disk image. Sparse disk image.
Wait. Back up. On the size of the partition, there's five different options.
No, it says
for a single partition.
There's five different options. Okay, whatever the default, so single partition, Apple partition map will do just fine.
Okay. Okay.
And then for image format, you pick sparse disk image.
Ah. Okay.
And then you click create, and then it exists.
Okay. So now it exists.
Yeah. So once it exists, you can just mount it by double clicking it. And then use either SuperDuper or rsync or whatever you're having yourself to back up everything from your disk into that mounted sparse disk image. And then you just click the eject button on the sparse disk image and the eject button on the external disk and stick it in your drawer.
Okay, so where in this whole encryption process did I ever tell it a password to encrypt it with?
When you hit save to create it, it would have asked you, give me a password.
Okay. And so should I use a good password on that, probably?
Oh, yeah. I would use a randomly generated one. And then stay. Huh?
What do you mean? Randomly generated by whom?
But the secure password generator on grc.com will do the trick for sure.
I'm afraid of that.
Why?
I'm going to make my own. Because I don't know how I'm going to get it back.
Well, you use something else for managing your passwords, like 1Password or something, don't you?
No, I got rid of it.
You got rid of it? You don't have any password manager?
I don't understand it. No, I don't understand any of that. I try and I don't get it. I don't understand.
Okay, in that case, write it down in a text file. Not ideal.
Well, you said something about keychain.
Yeah, okay. So on this machine itself, the machine that you created with, you can add it into the keychain, and that means you don't have to use it on a daily basis. But assuming your house explodes and your laptop is destroyed, that keychain entry is gone too, which is why I'm saying you need to actually save a copy of this password somewhere safe.
Good point. Good
so that
point.
When you come in with a completely different brand new machine that the insurance company has bought you, that you can actually mount the disk image, because without that password, that disk image is random noise. It is utterly 100% useless.
That's a really, really good point, because if our whole purpose in creating that backup is if something happens to the laptop, it would be really dumb to have the password to it on the laptop.
Yeah.
That'd probably be
it's
really
the kind of thing that I would actually make a big password, print it out, and if you have a safety deposit box, stick it in there.
There you go. Because if the house burns down or something, which is the reason you'd need that backup.
Yeah. It's your
How about
backup
if you just
in case
it
of
to the hard drive. Would that be a good play?
It may defeat the purpose of the security a teeny bit.
You know, that does
actually,
remind me
sorry, of just I'm speaking of a way to keep passwords safe in plain sight. We have one password, I'm not going to say what it does, but we have one password that is sort of an uber mega password at work, and it's very, very long. It's a bleeding essay. and it's almost impossible to remember because of that. So we have, what I do is I have a certain diary in which on different pages there are different parts of the password that have to be assembled in an order that I know. It doesn't say what the password does, it doesn't say where you use the password, but it has bits of the password scattered over a number of pages.
Oh, interesting.
And when I need it, I just reassemble them. And I know where that password goes, but no one else would. And it just looks like random scribblings in my diary because they're full of, you know, bracket, semicolon, star, square, bracket, you know.
Interesting. You know, my friend Niraj does an interesting thing with making strong passwords is he writes sentences, but they always seem fairly logical for the site that we're working on. And it's kind of interesting because a sentence with, you know, capital leading caps of the words, and then he puts punctuation in the middle of it. But the punctuation makes sense as you go through it. So they're really easy to remember and yet very complex.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing you want. A little in-joke is perfect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Throw in some leet speak in the middle of that, you know, make a three for a backwards E in there somewhere, that kind of thing, and then you're golden.
Yeah, like, you know, now, this is not a password I'm ever going to actually use, but a while ago we had a really hilarious incident in the coffee room, and the punchline of the joke was, let them eat cake. So if I were to be making a new password in work that I wanted to be remembered, I would bastardize that phrase, because we all remember it, because we all wet ourselves laughing so much.
Yeah, exactly. So it could be like L or capital L backwards E T, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But, you know, people will remember it. Oh, it's the let them eat cake password.
Right, right, right. Okay, well, this sounds pretty cool. So I can still use SuperDuper. Yep. I can use an external drive, and I seem to have them sprinkled all over the house. Actually, I did want to mention on the MacReviewcast number 202, which should have come out. Let's see, when you guys are hearing this, this would have been yesterday on Saturday the 14th. On number 202, I do a review of some software called DVD Imager, which is some really cool software for creating disk images of your DVDs. And
cool.
Bart, you had made some that little tisk-tisk noise to me about how I had my offsite backups of the DVDs, the home movies that Steve had made, and you said, yeah, but the DVDs are going to fail.
I did. Well, so they could fail, and a percentage of them will fail. Like I say, I got a real wake-up call a couple of months back, and we talked about it on the show at the time, where I grabbed some old DVDs. Now, it wasn't of critically vital, earth-shatteringly important stuff, but at the same time, I was still a bit miffed that my DVD backup had degraded and was unreadable.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that really scares me because these are, you know, each one of these has maybe 20 or 30 hours of work into it, and there are precious home movies.
Yeah.
And we thought we were covered because we had backups of them. So what I tried to do was create disk images using Disk Utility to put them onto a hard drive, and I was going to put that hard drive someplace offsite. But it turns out for some reason, Disk Utility simply wouldn't do it. I mean, it would start doing it, and it would always come back with an I/O error. And I searched on the internet, and I couldn't find any help for that. And it just nobody could find the solution to it. A lot of people are having the problem. And then Jonathan Cost of the Mac Tips Daily podcast told me about DVD Imager, and it's some freeware that simply its entire job is to make copies of your DVDs onto a hard drive. And this thing works beautifully. So I now have a solution, so now I can start the production of converting 60 homemade DVDs into disc images.
That could take a while, couldn't it?
It turns out it's not as bad as you would think, because you're not encoding those DVDs and you're not really doing anything but making a copy. It only takes about a half hour for each one. So even though they're 2 hours long, it's only a half hour.
Yeah, I guess, and most of that's probably I/O rather than being any sort of hard processor work. So it probably doesn't peg out your processors and stop you doing other things.
Right, right. So I'm going to take my old MacBook Pro, hook up a hard drive to it, and every time I walk by it, throw another DVD in there, and inside of a couple of weeks, I should have it done, yeah. I've just tried to decide which room to do it in where it's not going to annoy us, you know, hearing the thing chunking away, but...
That needs heating, perhaps.
Well, that's not the room where the G5 is, that's for sure. I told Steve, you know, if he ends up getting the new iMac for his birthday, that he's going to have to put on a coat when he's in his room, because his room is about 20 degrees hotter than the rest of the house.
The G5 central heating, as I call it.
That's a perfect explanation.
Oh, it makes a huge difference, because I remember a couple of years back, we were in a different house, and I had a much smaller bedroom than I have now, but we had run out of oil, and it was very frosty and very cold, and the only room in the house that was tolerable was my room, because it was full of computers.
You know, somebody suggested that that's a good thing, that it's a good heater. I said, you know, I'm just not sure that's super efficient.
It gives you pleasure and heats your room, I don't know. If it's the kind of place where it makes you turn on the air conditioning, it's certainly not efficient.
I think there's more efficient ways to make heat, though, than turning on processors and hard drive spinning, don't you think?
Yeah, probably. The electric heater is probably more efficient.
It's also liquid cooled too, remember? So it's got cooling going on while it's still pumping out all that heat.
No, the job of the liquid cooling is to take the heat off the CPU and put it into the air.
Oh, okay. So that is the heating process. Gotcha.
Yeah. So it's the cooling of the machine heats the room.
Well, he'll have to put on a jacket. That's all I'm saying.
I'm not so sure he will. Have you ever held your hand over the top of an iMac that's running?
Are they pretty warm?
Oh, yeah. The G5 ones were very warm, and I doubt the Intel ones have cooled down much. They have air vents at the back, so if you hold your hand over the screen, you'll feel them pumping out good and proper. Sort of like convection heaters, actually. Good shape to them. They suck in air at the bottom and spit out hot air at the top.
Well, I guess they got to do something, because they got it all inside the monitor, right?
Well, yeah, it does have to be cooled. Even monitors put out heat, let alone monitors containing your entire computer.
Yeah, actually, my friend Barb is having trouble with her brand new 24-inch cinema display, that it's got so much heat coming out of the bottom of it that it's actually making sort of wavy-looking lines across the bottom of her monitor. And she talked to the guy at Apple, and I don't think he really understood what she was saying. Well, he was saying, that happens. And I'm thinking, no, that should not happen. And it doesn't happen on mine. Mine isn't very warm at all.
I wonder. Some sort of manufacturing error on some of them.
I think so.
I just felt around the top of my Samsung, and apart from now being covered in dust, it's actually not putting out much heat at all.
Actually, now your hand is covered with dust, right?
Yeah, and it just fell all over my desk, actually. Where does that fluff come from? Why is there belly button fluff on the top of my monitor?
Ew, or maybe it's like little particles of skin. That's what they say, too.
Thanks.
Well, that's delightful. Well, you brought up the belly button. I wasn't going to say it. All right. Well, I will give you an update on my progress in doing my backups. I'm going to try to set that up this weekend and start my off-site-ness. That should be fun.
Excellent. Now, one thing, just important thing to bear in mind, is that you do have to remember to actually, you plug in the drive, and then you have to remember to mount the sparse disk image, because otherwise it ain't going to work.
Right, right. That makes sense. And the same thing happens with these disk images of the DVDs, is you have to double-click it.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is when you double-click it, it actually starts the DVD player, too, which is kind of cool. So as soon as you double-click a disk image, it starts to play. So, yeah, and they come across with the menus and everything. It's just beautiful.
Excellent. That's exactly what you want.
Yeah. All right, Bart. Well, it looks like we're about wrapped up here. Any more wisdom to impart to us?
Not really, other than the fact that I want another cup of coffee. That was very tasty.
All right, well, you go back to your coffee. I'm going to go get to work around this place.
Okie dokie. Until next time, happy computing.
Well, I'm really happy with how that recording came out because I did not record that. I botched up the recording. I had been doing some testing, and I did it when I was offline, and I didn't have Skype selected as the second audio input because I didn't have anybody on Skype with me. So I didn't do my recording at all. I shouldn't say that. I had a beautiful recording of me talking. So luckily, Bart has been smart enough lately to be pressing a button with call recorder and to record it for me. So after that great talk about backups, it was a really good idea that we had backups. Backup, backup, backup. Well, anyway, after I got off the horn with Bart, I was so inspired by this sparse disk image idea of doing an encrypted backup at work that I made a screen steps tutorial on how to do it. I posted it to the tutorial section over on podfeet.com. You can find that over in the right sidebar. So if any of you had trouble following those steps, I put the whole thing in with beautiful screenshots and everything. I love using screen steps for this kind of thing. It has a twofold benefit for me alone. One is that I'm forced to learn how to actually do something if I have to document it. It's sort of like if you teach something, you learn it. And the second big benefit is that I have it written down now so that if or when I forget how to do it, I'm going to be able to come back later and pick it up. Let me tell you, it happens a lot that I go back and watch my own screen steps tutorials. I sit there going, what did I say I was going to do? And that's not even counting the benefit to everyone else when I post these how-tos on the website. I think that $30 for that capability after the Nocilla discount coupon, that's my name, all capital letters spelled backwards, I think that's a really good deal for $30, don't you? You might want to give in on this one soon because, resistance is futile. It really is. Even George from Tulsa, who resisted for the longest time, is now a maniac at making screen steps tutorials. He just sent me a tutorial on how to download PDFs of my Schwab investments using screen steps. Debbie T of SplashTheStyle.com has always been great about doing tutorials on her website. Now she does them more easily and more readily and more happily because she uses screen steps. Heck, even Nightwise has started to use screen steps at my gentle nudging. Isn't it about time for you to give it a try? Head on over to ScreenSteps.com and don't forget to put in the coupon code to get your 25% off. All right, that's going to wrap up the show here for this week. Be sure to send me your dumb questions, comments, compliments, and even complaints over to Allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.